Are you familiar with that school of Zen? You know, there's a school of Zen where you bow, and then there's a school of Zen where you. See, I don't know school of Zen. I don't know. It was a little amusing when Doralee said that I'm the abbot of Yoshinji. I now have three sittings a week, and generally one or two people come. So it's kind of funny being abbot of, you know, two people, or, you know, me and one other person, and I'm the abbot, and there's and then on the days when nobody comes, it's even harder to, you know, be the abbot, but yeah. Edward. Sit up straight. But setting that aside, still, you know, I'm tonight especially, I'm feeling like I've kind of lost track of what do you do for these occasions, you know, where you give a talk. I was thinking about this last night, and I used some Zen stories, you know, because you know, it's a classic Zen saying that if you give instruction, it's like gouging a wound in good flesh. Did you think you needed some instruction? Is there some problem with your awareness? Don't you know, don't we all have unborn Buddha mind? Everyone in the room. And what do you need to know? And then you're lost, and then you're found, and it's in that, you know, another one of the poems we read, the mind of the great sage of India has been transmitted from east to west. Now you have it. Keep it well. Keep it, you know, take care of it. Take care of your awareness. Take care of your mind. Now you have it. Keep it well. So it's a little strange. It would be a little strange for me to try to say, you know what your problem is. And here's the medicine for it, you know. See, in order to give some medicine, you have to have a problem, you know, a sickness. And of course there are stories like Vimalakirti, the famous layperson, and he was sick, but he had a very unusual sickness, which was he had the sickness of all sentient beings. And the Buddha intuited this and asked his disciples, you know, please go call on Vimalakirti, he's sick with the sickness of all human beings. And nobody wanted to go because they'd all had experiences where Vimalakirti was more brilliant than they were. Finally, Manjushri went to see him, the Bodhisattva wisdom. Anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and talk anyway, as though I had something to say, and as though you might appreciate hearing something, whether you need to hear it or not, and that you might enjoy it. You know, you might not. I don't know. We'll see. I'm hoping that nobody throws tomatoes or any, you know, old eggs or anything. We'll see. Someone, I forget now, said that Mio requested I give tell a story tonight, but we can't figure out which story it was. Yeah, you see, I don't remember this story. So you can tell the story?
No, actually, I don't know.
It had to do with the role reversal in between those two themes.
Okay, I'm kind of having a vague recollection now of that story, but not enough to be able to tell it.
Neil really likes it. I hope you remember.
He doesn't remember it either, though. He wanted to.
Yeah. I'm kind of remembering that story now. Yeah. I hope I find it sometime because that is a good story. Yeah. But in the meantime, I thought of another story about someone in the hospital. So I thought I'd tell you that story. Huh? Yeah, close enough. Close enough. Yeah, it's a hospital. But there's a background to this story, which is this story was told to me by my friend Sharon. And there's a background to the story of how Sharon became my friend. So I'll tell you that story first, and we'll go from there. A long time ago now, 25 or 30 years ago, I went to Cleveland to teach some cooking classes. It was late September or early October, and they had told me they would have beautiful, fresh, red, ripe tomatoes. The tomatoes were orange and solid and not soft and ripe, and there were various other issues. Some of the ingredients hadn't arrived. So to do a cooking class, you kind of need to have the ingredients. And, of course, you also understand that if you're going to teach cooking, you're also trying to teach people that you make do with what you have, and you roll with the circumstances, and you adjust, and you accommodate to how things are, the way things are, rather than the way you'd like them to be and that you planned on and so on. But nonetheless, the class started, and I said, good afternoon, and thank you for coming. And I am feeling kind of anxious because we don't have all the ingredients here, and we'll see what happens. But I'm kind of feeling nervous and anxious. And right away, a woman raises her hand and says, yes. And she says, Ed, what do you have to be nervous or anxious about? You've been practicing Zen for more than 25 or 30 years. Is this how you understand Zen? Do you get to have any feelings? Or after 25 or 30 years of practice, you're above them, you've eliminated them, you've transcended them? So what is the Zen school? What do you get to have feelings, or are you going to be masterful and impassive? I am Zen man. I don't get anxious, and so on. So I tried to say that I wasn't in that particular school of Zen where you didn't have feelings, and that my idea was you could have feelings. And you knew what you were feeling when you felt it, and you were able to express it in a way that connected you with other people. And, not where you express your emotion and then people are running or backing out of the room, turning and running or backing away. I've been in those situations too, where... because even though that's my intention, that's not always what happens. Anyway, we had this class, and I don't know that woman's name. I've never seen her since. I've never heard from her. We don't know each other anymore. So that's not what happened.
That was not Sharon.
So later that year, or the next year, I was at Tassajara for a Zen and cooking workshop. And I said, and we were meeting in the Tassajara dining room on the porch of the dining room. Now there's, you know, new these retreat center, retreat buildings out on the, what used to be the flats. And I don't know what they call these things now anymore. But we were meeting on the porch of the dining room. We had three tables together with these bright red tablecloths. And 16 or 18 people sitting around the table. Ocean of red. That's pretty sweet. And it's the morning, and there's sunlight outside in the alder trees, and the sunlight is coming through the trees and the branches and the leaves, and blue sky past the trees. And I said, good morning. And, you know, I'm feeling kind of anxious today. All of my notes from my class, I had to move out of my cabin this morning, and all of a sudden, and all my belongings, including the notes, were put in three carts that are out on the roadway there with white sheets over them. I have no idea where my notes are. And I don't usually use notes, but I like to have them just in case. These aren't the notes for today's class, but, you know. And there was a woman sitting next to me, and she grabbed my right wrist. And she pulled it up, and she was pulling, and I, like, it looks to me like my hand is going right to the middle of her, right between her breasts. And I thought, that's not how we behave here at Tassajara. This is a Zen center. And sure enough, my hand ended up right between her breasts. I thought, what is my hand doing between these women's breasts? And I could feel with my finger here, there's a breast, and then over here, there's a... Then she says, are you nervous? I'm nervous too. And then I notice like her heart is going thumpity, thumpity, thump, 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 thumpity, thumpity. And I say, wow, your heart is really pounding away. You are nervous. And then she said, I'll bet we all are. It's the first morning of the first class. That's Sharon. And we've been friends now for 30 years. And we connected because we both feel anxious and we are fine about being with somebody else who feels anxious. And we're not judging the other person and saying, you need to get over it. Grow up. You know, these are just temporary phenomena that you can transcend, and you don't really need to feel scared or anxious or nervous ever again, you know. I don't know. So we're not judging each other, you know, and we're not telling each other how to feel differently than you're feeling. Grief is like this too, of course. Grief is the biggest, you know, one of the big ones, because when you're small and your pet dies and you're sad, then mom and dad say, don't be sad, we'll get you another cat. And something more painful happens, you know, it's God's will, or you know, it's, you know, you'll get over it, time passes, and people basically tell you not to grieve. So classically with grief, if you look at, you know, James and Friedman, I think Friedman and James, they wrote this classic book on the grief recovery, and they say, when some grief happens, it always is going to bring up the grief of your whole life. This is why it's so challenging. And then it's a big commitment to say, okay, I'm finally, whatever age you are, I'm willing to grieve the grief of my whole life. And they give you a way to do it. You know, you start and you map out. And it's easier if you do it with a grief partner, but you map out what happened when you were born, what happened, you know. And sometimes, of course, your grief goes back before birth and so on. And you map it all out, and then you can grieve the grief of your life. Or should you be a Zen person and grow up? Boys don't cry. And, of course, there's many people, Michael Mead and Robert Bly and the people who did men's work, who say, you know, for men to have an inner life, usually the gateway is grief and tears. Because otherwise men are stone. And the water of tears is what melts the stone. Just talking, you know, just talking. But on the other hand, it's very difficult to cry. I mean, there's not much permission for it. And if I may be frank with you, after 20 years at the Zen Center, I left so I could cry. I didn't feel a lot of support. And if I'm the head teacher, and I didn't think I could sit up in front of the room and sob. You're our teacher. You're crying? What kind of baby are you? And students are merciless, you know. Students are like kids. You know, just merciless. Anyway. So Sharon and I have been friends. And I used to go to Boston much more often. She lives in Boston. She and her husband have a house that's three levels. It's actually three different buildings, and they rent out the lower building, and then Sharon lives in the middle building, and John lives in the upper building. And John's building also has a tower that goes up two stories above his house. So he's got the best view. And guess what, though? So they each have their own house. But when John wants to eat, he goes to Sharon's. And Sharon has always five or six cats, and Sharon's cats never get to go outside. And John always has five or eight cats, and they can go outside. And so anyway, they're really big and taking care of cats being donors to the cat and dog places. And there's farms near there, or places where they take in, you know, injured horses and all kinds of things. So they're big benefactors for, you know, animals that need help. So at that time, one of the first times I visited Sharon, at that time she was still working as a nurse for the homeless. This is a woman who's shorter than I am. And Sharon would go out and she would see 120 or so clients a week who had, and to qualify for her to see, they had to refuse to go into shelter. And they had to have a medical condition that required weekly attention, you know. AIDS, tuberculosis, you know, diabetes, things that you could check on. One time we were driving down Storo Drive and there's an overpass and she says, a lot of my clients live up there. I said, you don't go up there, do you? And she said, no, I send somebody up to tell people that I'm down here on the street. And she knew all the homeless people. So we'd drive like to South Station. You come off the freeway and there's a guy there, you know, food, money or something. He's got a sign. And Sharon would say, you see the way he's nodding his head? He's on drugs. And then other people, she'd say, hey, Tommy, how nice to see you. And she'd say, here's $5, you know, because people are standing at the stoplights and she knew them all. And bless her heart, you know, she would stop for all of them and say hi, and, you know. It's amazing. So one time, one of her clients, she got a phone call, and one of her clients had been taken into the hospital. He'd had some kind of an emergency, so they'd taken him right into a hospital. And Sharon went there as quickly as she could because she knew that, I think his name was Billy, that Billy just did not like hospitals. They were, you know, he was very scared in the hospital, very terrified, and didn't know what to do in the hospital. Sharon got there as soon as she could, and and Billy had been screaming and cussing out the hospital people and swearing at them. And so, I mean, duh, what do? You strap him down on the gurney with his face down. And you strap him down, you strap his head down. He was still doing his best to scream. This is America. It's not just Zen. And we're not sure about Zen, whether we can cry or, you know, what can happen. And Sharon went over to where he was on his gurney, and it was by the wall, and right at that place there was a curtain that you could pull around the gurney. So she pulled the gurney shut, and she said, I didn't know what to do. So I pulled up a chair, and I sat down next to him, and I put my hand on his back. And I said, Billy, it's me, Sharon, and I'll stay here as long as you want. And he started to quiet down. And then she started rubbing his back. And after a little bit, Billy said, that feels so good. And about that time, there was a little gap in the curtain, and a nurse across the room said, do you see what that woman is doing? She's touching that filthy drunk. She's touching him. Can you believe it? That filthy drunk who was screaming, she's touching him. So who are you in this story? You know. And as far as I can tell, we're all of these people, you know. Because I don't know about you, but you know, we growing up, you know, most of us as kids were too exuberant, too much energy, and we had to, you know, zip it up. Quiet down. Go to your room. Stop it. You know, and in our way, and then we learned to do this to ourselves. You know, we were a little too exuberant or a little too, you know, upset or something, and we learned to. One of my earliest memories, maybe my earliest memory, is I was at the orphanage, and I was saying some words that seemed kind of fun to me to say. I don't know what words they were, and the woman said, stop that. Stop saying those words. And I went on saying them, and she said, if you don't stop saying those words, I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. And I said the words a couple more times. I don't know what they were. And sure enough, you know, got out the bar of soap. Here, chew on this. You learn. Keep your mouth shut. How many years did it take me? I know I've got all these books, but, you know, I didn't say much until I was 38 or 40. I was practicing Zen. And we don't talk, you know, we just sit and face the wall, and it's spiritual. Commune with the divine, or, you know, the beyond, or the absolute. Anyway, so I'm the person who got shut up. And who did the tying up? That was me. I didn't know any better, but I tied myself up. You know, as a little boy, I used to have dreams. Oh my God, I've murdered a little boy and we buried him in the rice fields. Who was that little boy? God, I hope they don't find out. So I've been there. I've been the person strapped down. We strap ourselves down, and you know it's just what we human beings do. You know, the protector shows up to protect you. And the protector says, "Don't say that. Don't do that." And that protector saved you. And you want to say thank you. One of the things you can do, which I finally did. Protector did a great job. Still alive today. Made it through. Wouldn't have known what to do without having that protector to tell me, don't say that. Don't do that. And you sit down with your protector and you say, thank you. Good job. Wonderful. Made a big difference in my life. You really saved my ass because, you know, I didn't know what to do. But you helped me out there. Don't talk. Keep quiet. Don't get in trouble. know. And then you, after you thank your protector, you say, "So, excuse me, but how old do you think I am now?" Protector says, 7. Then you have to explain. Excuse me, but while you were busy telling me what to do and what not to do, I've been growing up, and actually I'm 74 now. I'd like you to kind of recalibrate how you talk to me. Because this protector turns out to be, as you get older and older, not just your protector, but your persecutor. And it's more like being strapped down in the hospital than it is like keeping you out of trouble when you're small and you need to be sure you don't, the big people don't really take offense to you. You know? You're small. So you want to get your protector to treat you a little more. Like, I'm 74, so you don't need to just tell me to shut up and don't say that. You need, you know, let me say things and then let's talk it over, you know. And then, so you give me permission to keep studying, keep finding the way to talk in a way that works. And then once I've tried this and if it doesn't work, then let's talk about it. You know, we're working on this. And I've been the person, sweetheart, it's okay. You better keep it down now, because if you don't, they're going to hurt you. So that's the other thing that Sharon said to him. Billy, I'll be here as long as you want, but do me a favor. Don't scream anymore, because if you do, they are going to hurt you. So that's a different kind of protector, you know. It's not just a protector, it's kind of wise, it's kind of wisdom and compassion, you know. So it's pretty interesting to have friends like Sharon. And then the other, it's already 8:30. We don't have much more time now. So do we go on to other? Are there any defenders? Oh, yeah, thank you. Well, just coincidentally, this is a bit of an aside, but to start my new Zendo, I had to remove the tenants who were living there. I had to have them move out and all of their things. And to make a long story short, at one point there, a process server comes to leave, you know, present them with papers. And first of all, my tenant, I don't know what you can say anymore. Anyway, my tenant said, no, he is not Vincent. So, but the next thing he did once the papers were there is he went from his tenant unit down the sidewalk, up the steps of my house, and threw the papers down on my porch. And then the process server was down at the bottom of the steps and was like, are you sure you're not Vincent? you're sure behaving like somebody who just got presented with papers that applies to him. Anyway, and my real estate attorney called. Was that Vincent? And I said, yeah. And then not so long after that, Vincent was on my front porch banging on the door. And I don't know if it was a mistake or not, but I opened the door and he started in on, how long have I lived here? You know, a couple of years. And you know, I don't know if to have to say, well, you know, long enough for me to know you don't always pay your rent on time, dude. but anyway, he began to approach me from the far side of the porch, and he came up to me and he explained to me how he was going to rearrange my face. And is that something I would appreciate him doing for me? Is that what you want me to do? You want me to smash your face in? And I said, no. And then after a bit of that, I closed the door vigorously so that he couldn't come in after me, and I called the Fairfax police. And then the Fairfax police came and they asked me what happened, and I explained to them. And the papers are still all over the porch. So, and he said, the policeman said, you can charge him with threatening you if you want, but also we could just go visit with him. I said, that's fine with me. And the policeman said, I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, the policeman is so good. The policeman said, I just talked to him and say, understand, you know, you're really upset. This is really upsetting to have an eviction notice. Really upsetting. But you have to behave in a civil manner. It was so straightforward and matter of fact. Understand, this is upsetting. You have a right to be upset. You know, you have every right to be upset, but you have to behave in a civil manner. You can't be threatening people. And then, of course, he denied that he had been threatening me. But then another police car came, and neighbors, of course, were starting to wonder what's going on. And they talked to him for about 15 minutes. And at some point in all of that, they had him pick up the papers from my porch. But it's so interesting, you know, what we do in these situations. I felt I needed help. So I did bring this poem. I've been using this poem this weekend, and I'll see if I can tell you the poem. And then if I need to, I can look down at the paper and tell you what I'm missing. But it's the Rumi poem called The Guest House, which is pretty well known. And this weekend and this year, I've been thinking about, and here I am, you know, moving my tenants out and making a zendo at my own house. So my whole house now is my house and temple. And anybody living there is part of the house and temple and not some person who doesn't want to talk to me or doesn't want to pay their rent. Anyway, I'm so relieved to have a home. So there's a lot to be said about home, which is what I've been talking about this weekend, and what makes home home. So this is Rumi's idea about this being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Then the challenging part comes. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows, come to violently sweep your house empty of all its furniture. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. I'll check here. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, greet them each at the door laughing. And invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Greet them all. Be grateful for them all, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So this to me is a pretty good sense of, you know, meditation. The nice thing about meditation is that there's not a big person threatening to rearrange your face. So you can feel sort of safe about welcoming and inviting in what arrives while you're sitting. And we assume that the room is secure. So we can have a joy, a depression, a meanness. We can have a dark thought, shame, malice. And we can spend some time with them. Or not. Or, you know, we can, in my world, it's more like if you don't want to have them show up, you need to tie yourself down. You knot it up inside where the feelings are. You close up those places. You learn it really well when you learn it better when you're small, but you know you can still do it. And different emotions are, of course, in different places in your body, so you get a grip there. I didn't make this up. I'm just repeating what, you know, people who know better than I do say, you know. Excuse me. Anyway, so, you know, we're opening up the treasure store. The treasure store will open and you will spend freely. And at the first opening, there's a meanness, there's anger. And then, you know, below that or inside that, in the treasure store, there's your, you know, your energy, your vitality, your creativity that was too much for the big people when you were small. And it's too much and it might be too much in your family, and you might have to go out dancing or, you know, find people to do a yoga with or qigong or, you know, some people I know, they do theater improv. Theater improv is very much like sitting. Sitting, you get to experience the joy, the meanness, the malice, because you don't do anything. You're not acting it out, and you're not saying anything, so then you can let it all arise freely. And then it can arise, and it can actually disperse, and you have access to this treasure store. Vitality, energy, your gifts, your exuberance, your creativity, the muses, your determination, your resilience. That's all, you know, inside there. Oh, so, you know, so theater improv, anything can occur to you, and you get to act it out. But it's just acting. You can murder somebody, but, you know, you don't actually murder them. You just act it out. And you act it out in a safe way, because that's, you know, what we're doing in theater improv. We're not acting it out literally. It's theater. So it's very interesting, you know. So people find all kinds of things to do. Last night, a couple came and said, Oh, we found this fabulous couple that teaches tango. And if you've ever studied tango, you know it's about being in your core and moving from your core. And then you see people who have some sense of this, and it's like, oh my God. So anyway, time's up. please find things to do that help you untangle the tangle. That's the classic Buddhist way, you know, but otherwise known as, you know, unstrap the, you know, who's binding you? Was the Zen story, you know, how do I attain liberation? Well, who's binding you? Well, I didn't do that. Well, even though you didn't do it, you didn't do it as a conscious adult person. You did it as an unconscious child, and the protector came along, and you didn't really do that, but the protector moved in to keep you in line. And, you know, what are you going to do to move into your, you know, your freedom and let your treasure store open? And to me, anyway, the treasure store opening is associated with, there's some feelings at the, we don't open those doors because there's feelings there. But, you know, that's just me. You know, other people have their own ideas. And you get to have your own ideas. And you have the mind of the great sage of India, and, you know, you want to take care of it and see what you want to do with the mind, with your mind, with your, what Mary Oliver calls her one wild and precious life. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? And that's a pretty important question. Anyway, thank you so much for being here tonight and sharing your warm-hearted attention and your warm-hearted practice. Felt very nice in this space tonight. Thank you.